Welcome to the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Catherine Ident. Today we'll discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with my colleagues in print and digital media. Today we'll hear from WCAI Sam Houghton, Jeanette Barnes, and Eve Zuckoff. Jessica Hill of the Cape Cod Times will join us, as well as Brian Dowd of the Martha's Vineyard Times. And we'll check in on the top stories of the week from the State House with WCAI's Mike Dean. But first, the state is taking a big step forward on offshore wind development. The Baker administration announced this week Vineyard Wind and Mayflower Wind have agreed to lease the New Bedford Marine Commerce Terminal as a full-time base for the construction of the company's offshore wind projects. And here to talk about this and more is WCAI's Eve Zuckoff and Jeanette Barnes. Welcome to you both.
Hi there, Katie.
Hi.
Hi. Eve, start off, tell us about the details of this agreement and what it means for the city of New Bedford.
Yeah, so this lease agreement is set to start in 2023 and last for about 4.5 years for the construction and installation of these wind farms. And the lease agreements themselves are worth more than $32 million. So this is a pretty nice payday for the state, no matter what happens with these projects, which we can get into a bit more later. And at this point, there's a lot of optimism for what it'll mean for really New Bedford, the whole South Coast and Cape area, in terms of economic development and job creation. Because this is a port that's primed for this. I mean, New Bedford has the only custom-built facility to support the construction for offshore wind farms in North America. And in the statement, New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell called it really welcome news.
Oh, I'm sure he is happy to hear this news, especially since this terminal was built years ago, and there's been some delays and other pieces that we can talk about. Jeanette, Vineyard Wind's lease agreement amends an existing agreement. Is that right?
Yes. So Vineyard Wind first signed a lease for the terminal almost 2 years ago in October of 2018. There was a signing ceremony at that time with Governor Baker and the CEO of Vineyard Wind. Vineyard Wind had actually first committed to use the terminal 2 years before that in 2016 when it was bidding for the wind farm. All three of the bidders at that time signed a letter of intent to stage their construction from the terminal. The term of the lease was originally 18 months, and it wasn't supposed to start until this December of 2020. But of course, in the interim, a lot has happened with the additional view being required by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. So that's delayed the project.
Right. And there were tax credits involved with this as well. And so when we heard the news that the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management wanted to take a closer look, I think a lot of people wondered what the next steps would be and whether or not wind companies that had already put some money on the line would kind of be able to pivot. Eve, the Trump administration has delayed developers, as I was just kind of saying. So what does this agreement signal?
Yeah, so as you're saying, I mean, gumming up this whole plan is that construction for 2023 isn't a certain thing. This environmental review has really created kind of a year-long hold on this whole project, mm-hmm. and that's really because of concerns about the fishing industry that has said, you know, if Vineyard Wind continues, Rhode Island and some other kind of major coastal states will not have a commercial fishing industry. So that's pretty significant. But the state says these companies are just clearly really confident that they'll be able to answer the very legitimate questions of the federal government, and they can develop offshore wind projects in a responsible way. That's kind of the official party line here. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one representative from the state told me, look, this is an opportunity to literally launch a new industry in the U.S. from a port in New Bedford. So, yes, it does come with risks, as it would in any industry, in any time that you're dealing with something of that scale.
Mm. Right. And so it's interesting to see that they are trying to move forward, but there still are some roadblocks. And of course, as you were saying, too, not everybody is happy or excited about the potential for offshore wind, in particular fishermen. It's a story we've been keeping a close eye on and will continue to do so as we go forward. In other news, schools, of course, we're heading closer to fall when the school year starts up again. And both of you this week were covering some stories that had to deal with preparations. First, Eve, it looks like dozens, maybe hundreds of teachers staged protests in communities all over the region. And they're concerned about a variety of things, including the safety of returning to school for in-person classes. And you talked with some teachers in Sandwich to hear some more details.
Yeah, that's right. So it was actually 11 demonstrations all across the Cape and Islands where teachers are calling for healthy and safe working and learning conditions in public schools, which is ultimately, to them, that means starting with remote learning. That's the only way at this point to protect students, teachers, and families from the spread of COVID-19. Because what they're saying is that these hybrid plans have a lot of really great top-down information, but they're kind of missing some day-in, day-out protocol. So, you know, if you have students in 4 days a week or on a rotating schedule, and you're teaching, you know, 20 fifth graders, how do you sanitize the hall passes while also teaching? How do you sanitize the pencil sharpener while you're also teaching to a group of kids online and a group of kids in front of you? I mean, they were saying they just have no idea yet the details, and the devil is in the details and things like that. And one major thing holding up the process for schools all across the state, actually, is that teachers are really looking for more information about air circulation. They want to understand the HVAC systems in their school to make sure that, you know, infected air isn't being circulated in some rooms, and, you know, that could infect an entire classroom worth of kids. So in Sandwich, they were saying, we're still waiting on the report that gives us a sense of which classrooms are circulating the air within the room. And we don't have that yet. And we don't feel good going back to school until we can figure out which rooms those are.
Mm-hmm. And we've heard stories of school officials saying, well, we're going to keep the windows open. And there are even some districts around the state that are looking at, like in Worcester, that are spending millions to upgrade the HVAC. But this is an unexpected budget expense, and we don't have a clear idea even from the state about what the budget is and what monies are coming to cities and towns and schools. So this HVAC thing is I think, a quandary for some people. You know, you've got some old school buildings. You've got some buildings that were built in the 60s and 70s that don't have windows. I guess in a way you can see why school officials and teachers are taking a hard look at what air quality is like in a way they might not have before.
That's right. That's right. And I think what they really said to me, almost every teacher repeated, was, look, we want to get back to work. We want, you know, after months of learning how to teach remotely, getting some practice, and yes, it did go that well, we want to be teaching students, but we just, I talked to one teacher who said, I'm a fifth grade teacher. I'm an English middle school English teacher. I don't know anything about HVAC systems. So can we just wait 2 weeks? Can we wait 2 weeks to get this report out from the people who do know before we go back into these buildings?
Mm. And of course, two school districts have been hard at work all summer on reopening plans, which they submitted to the state. But as the virus kind of shifts and changes across the region, it will be interesting to see how these plans need to shift. And there's already news this week that, of course, Barnstable has re-amended its plan for its district as they get new data and new information. And so amid these concerns, the county and health officials met with some school officials from districts around the Cape yesterday to try to talk a little bit more about these concerns. And Jeanette, you sat in on that conversation.
Yes, so they had a video meeting that school officials and school committee members from around the Cape and Islands were welcome to tune into. And some people on there shared really specific details about what they're doing. It was food for thought, I think. So the Sandwich Fire Chief, J.J. Burke, who many people may know, has actually studied pandemic response in his academic background, shared specifics of the plan that he worked on for town employees in Sandwich, which will tentatively be rolled out for teachers and other school employees next week. And I should mention that's voluntary, but the idea is that everyone gets a blood test, and this is done just with a small finger prick like a blood sugar test. That's the test that shows if you have late-stage COVID or a previous infection. If your blood shows either one of those things, then you get the nasal swab test. to rule out an active COVID infection.
Mm.
So that's a model that he says has worked well for town employees and one that schools could follow across the Cape if they choose to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And on another issue, the Hyannis Fire Chief, Peter Burke, talked about a number of disinfectant products that he has experience with, and he recommended chlorine products as, you know, effective and relatively safe. He said people may have seen a Facebook video of some fire departments using low-pressure sprayers that you might use at your house to spray disinfectant in classrooms. He says that really uses far more of the product, the disinfectant product, than you need, and also it actually damaged some equipment because of the corrosive nature of all that high-volume spray.
Mm, it's harsh stuff.
It is, yeah. And then one thing he also really recommended against using was air foggers that are designed not to disinfect surfaces, but the air itself. He said those are really more of a feel-good thing that's not necessarily proven effective.
Mm. It really demonstrates, Jeanette, how much information that people have to weigh through. And as Eve pointed out, teachers feeling like they're out of their depth, right? They don't specialize in HVAC and disinfectant chemicals. And neither do school administrators as well, right? Their focus is education. So this is a lot to try to pull together to make sure they're doing things the best way they can.
Right.
Jeanette, you also sat in on another big meeting, a region-wide meeting yesterday. This is a completely different subject, but it focuses on housing. And there are some concerns about a potential eviction crisis kind of juxtaposed against soaring home prices.
Right. So just when perhaps people thought real estate couldn't get any more expensive or hot on the Cape, home sales are booming over the last few months, and the median sale price of home is rising. Ryan Castle of the Cape and Islands Association of Realtors said during that meeting that it used to be mainly homes under $450,000 that would get snapped up kind of immediately, almost before they went on the market, and now that's really starting to happen at all price levels. So there was some speculation or discussion that perhaps, you know, people who are more able to work remotely from home now have a greater interest in moving to the Cape,
mm-hmm.
that they could be bringing higher incomes from major metropolitan areas, and that could be good in some sense for the Cape's economy, but this housing thing is going to continue to be a problem. Lisa Magnata, who's from the Housing Assistance Corporation, said she kind of feels that the prices combined with unemployment from the pandemic could really create a situation where more people, once the eviction moratorium expires shortly, that more people could be evicted. She said they did a survey recently of landlords, and 40% said they had a tenant who was behind on the rent.
Hmm. Right. So this could be a huge impending crisis. And I wonder, too, was there any talk about with this hot real estate market of landlords saying, I don't want to be a landlord anymore and selling their homes? Would that kind of shift the rental landscape even more?
Yes, that was one thing they discussed as well, that if landlords decide they want to get out, we could have housing units now that are year-round rentals that are, you know, really needed on the Cape, could be converted either to, you know, a single family home that's not rented or to a summer rental.
Mm. A lot to consider there. Did they talk at all about the moratorium? It was already extended once, and I think you mentioned October. Any hope or any pressure from Cape housing advocates to the state to try to get that moratorium extended, or is there a general feeling that it will end in October?
I'm not sure about that. They did talk a little bit about some state legislation, but about the moratorium, I'm not sure.
Okay, we'll have to keep an eye on that. With me now are WCAI reporters Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. Coming up a little bit later, we'll check in with the Martha's Vineyard Times and talk about news from the State House. But first, Jeanette, I want to talk about the mosquito-borne illness, Eastern Equine Encephalitis. We also call it Triple E. It has been detected in some parts of the state earlier this month. It's been a story we've been reporting on. CAPE officials have not detected it just yet, to our knowledge, but they are keeping a sharp eye on its arrival here, I should say, because Triple E can make humans very sick, and sometimes it can be fatal.
Right, right. I spoke this week to Blake Dinius, who is the entomologist educator for Plymouth County Extension. Some of these reminders are things that people hear every year, but there's always a little, like, new tidbit in there that makes you really kind of think about what you're doing. And this year, he talked a little bit about standing water. We've all heard that, but it's as small as a bottle cap. A little amount of water in your yard as small as a bottle cap can breed mosquitoes. And something people may not know, tires is a big harbor for that standing water, but the county mosquito control in your area should take away tires from your property for free, he said.
That is so cool. I didn't know about that. It seems so unusual that they would be taking your tires, but as you just mentioned, there's a real risk there if you have tires on your property.
Right, right. And another thing he mentions that a lot of people have, I actually have them myself, is these downspout extenders. Mm-hmm. So they're those things that are often plastic and they sort of fold in an accordion style and you pull them out and you use them to get water away from your foundation because they're flat, because they have those accordion folds that trap water. They are a big harbor for mosquitoes as well.
Wow. Something that you would never think of. You know, you walk around. I walked around my yard, actually, after I heard your story this week, this exact story we're talking about, and a bottle cap. I mean, there's just so many things potentially in your yard that could hold a bottle cap's worth of water and, you know, downspout. I never would have thought of that.
Right, right. Another thing that was new to me, we've all heard kind of this warning about, you know, not spending a lot of time outdoors at dawn and dusk because, you know, more mosquitoes come out, you'll get bitten. But he says it's not even just that it's more mosquitoes, it's which species. And some mosquito species transmit Triple E more easily than others. The ones that are out at dawn and dusk are really good at transmitting Triple E, which is really kind of frightening. So
it really is kind of frightening. And of course, as I mentioned, the Cape Cod Mosquito Control Project and other mosquito control projects around the state are taking samples from around their respective districts and testing these mosquitoes to see if they are carriers so that they can alert the public. But I guess it's safe to say that we should kind of almost just act as if it is here and make sure we take those precautions.
Right, right. And he and another entomologist I spoke to, they mentioned the EPA-registered repellent. So there are now some EPA-registered repellents that have natural ingredients for people who are concerned about that. Many of them have DEET, which they said, you know, Dinius from the extension said has been used for many years. And he believes it's safe, but there are alternatives too. And there's a website on the EPA where you can look up all the registered repellents that are proven effective or have, you know, been demonstrated effective to the EPA's satisfaction and what's in them.
All right. That's a good little tool for us to use. Thank you for that, Jeanette. I want to take a look at another animal-related story. Eve, this is one that you've been following. The Conservation Law Foundation, which is based in Boston, it's an environmental advocacy group, is suing a federal agency, and it says it hasn't done enough to protect the endangered North Atlantic right whale.
That's exactly right. So basically, what has happened kind of most recently is that the federal judge in this case has ordered the National Marine Fisheries Service to issue new rules protecting these whales, because back in April, the judge ruled that the agency had actually violated the Endangered Species Act when it authorized the American lobster fishery without, you know, appropriately assessing the fishery's impact on right whales, because these right whales, their leading cause of death is entanglement, and much of that entanglement is in trap pot gear. So really, what's going to happen in the next year or so is by the May 31st, the National Marine Fisheries Service needs to come out with new rules that include, you know, speed reductions, fishing closures, and gear replacements to reduce the whale's risk of fatal entanglement in fishing gear by 60 to 80%. This is no small task.
No, not at all. That's a lot. That's massive. It's practically all of it. What are the National Marine Fisheries Service and lobstermen? There's a lobstermen association. What are these groups saying about this news?
Yeah, we haven't heard much yet from the National Marine Fisheries Service, but, you know, the conservationists in this case didn't get everything they asked for. They wanted the Marine Fisheries Service to have these new rules come out by January 31st. So they have a couple extra months to do that. And the Lobstermen, Massachusetts Lobstermen Association, is happy because of two reasons. They, first of all, are pleased that the judge is allowing the rulemaking process to continue through the federal agency that kind of has a real understanding of stocks and fishery management, and that the rules aren't being set by the courts. So they're pretty happy about that. And then they also had a small win in terms of one thing that conservationists really wanted was a area off Nantucket to be closed to fishing, to vertical buoy lines that are kind of hanging down, because it's been seen that North Atlantic right whales kind of like this area to socialize, to feed. And until the rules come out, conservationists said, we really want that area to be closed to fishing. And the judge said, no, we're not going to do that. So fishermen have something to celebrate there. This is not a total, you know, win for conservationists.
And it is, you know, really illustrates the struggle between trying to protect an endangered species that is dangerously close to extinction, but also the life of a fisherman, a lobsterman, is not easy. And there are a lot of challenges, especially in the COVID-19 pandemic. And, you know, there are, of course, advocates for both sides. And it's difficult to find something that will help each side kind of see their goals met. So this is a story we will continue to follow. That is Eve Zukoff, WCAI's climate and environment reporter. Eve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I want to thank Jeanette Barnes, WCAI reporter as well, for joining us this morning to talk about some of the stories that you followed this week. Jeanette, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Katie.
It's been nearly 3 months since George Floyd was killed by Minneapolis police, and protests erupted around the country, including on the Cape, the South Coast, and the islands. And since then, a group of teens has banded together to keep racism on the Cape part of the community discussion. Cape Cod Times reporter Jessica Hill talked with some of the members of this group, and she joins us now. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us this morning. Talk more about this group of teens and what they're hoping to do.
Right. So it's actually not a group of teenagers. They're all graduated from high school.
Oh, okay.
Doing their master's degrees and those things. But they remember their time in Cape Cod schools. And they remember feeling some microaggressions and different experiences that many people of color on the Cape feel. And having been raised and born on the Cape, a lot of them are also saying that every single person of color has experienced some form of racism or microaggressions on the Cape, whereas there's this perception that Cape Cod is doing something great. You know, we are an example for other schools and towns to follow. And they really wanted to take the opportunity to let other people who are people of color really talk about their own experiences. And so this organization formed in June and held a speaking event in Hyannis in July where people of color could come and kind of just share their experiences. One of the main things that they are focusing on is addressing racism, systemic racism in schools on the Cape. Some have talked about how they never had a black teacher or just a teacher of color at all throughout their time at school, and they wanted to see changes in the faculty. They also remember being called racial slurs during school. So they want to, right now, they are focusing on creating surveys for people of color in school right now to talk about their own experiences, and then they're going to start to figure out how to address those problems. They plan to hold different workshops and lectures in schools and kind of begin doing more in-person ground root work.
And as you said, this group formed in June in response to the unrest we saw across the country in the Black Lives Matter movement. And I think it's interesting to hear that they're trying to focus now specifically on schools. We've seen on social media posts by teens talking about racism and calling out microaggressions in a way that we might not have seen before. And also, too, earlier this summer, we talked about several letters that students, alumni, and current students wrote to districts Barnstable and Sandwich, to be specific, asking them to take a hard look at the deeply rooted issues of systemic racism and not just to kind of pay lip service to diversity that may, you know, that some feel might have been happening in the past. So this is, sounds like a big job ahead for this group.
Definitely, definitely. And they are focusing on schools, but also the community in general on the Cape, you know, adults as well. But they do believe that school is a big problem on the Cape.
In other news, Governor Charlie Baker announced new tighter regulations for crowd sizes, both indoors and outside, after some clusters of COVID-19 outbreaks, like one we saw earlier this summer that happened in Chatham. But now local police are saying they want some more clarification. They want extra guidance on how to actually enforce some of the governor's crowd restrictions when it comes to things like private parties.
Definitely. Yeah. So when Governor Baker announced that new enforcement, including both police and health inspectors to enforce public health mandates, especially at private parties and gatherings, some police chiefs and health agents have been a little bit confused. They were wondering how they could legally enforce some of these public health mandates on private property. And they, people on the Cape, police officers on the Cape, have remained a little hesitant about really enforcing this. As there are some, you know, different legalities attached to entering private property. And currently, some people are saying that, you know, it does put them in a tough spot, especially because they're under, so many police officers are under a microscope following the death of George Floyd in Minnesota. So they are worried about really enforcing this mask mandate.
Yeah, it sounds too like they're concerned with the fact that while the governor has tried to put some teeth behind his mandates, it's not like a noise complaint where so many towns have bylaws. So if a, you know, a police officer is doing a round and hears a loud party or there's a complaint, that officer can go and address the issue. If there are cars parked outside someone's house and it looks like a party, I can imagine it even perhaps maybe being a liability for a police officer to venture over and find out what's going on.
Definitely. That's a big concern. A lot of people, or some different police chiefs that we talked to for this article, were talking about how it's different when it is a private party versus on public ground. And then when it comes to enforcing, they're worried that it might be easier and better. They found that it's easier to enforce based off of just public education and making it like a voluntary compliance rather than actually enforcing things. And then one police chief we talked to had talked about it might be easier if we actually had town bylaws, but that would take time to actually install and establish in each town.
Yeah, and that has to go through town meeting and things like that. It's not something they can do overnight. I think it's interesting, too, that some police chiefs are kind of worried about their local health agents who have been tasked with a lot of enforcement as well during this crisis and, you know, just putting themselves out there and not necessarily, again, having the teeth, if you will, for lack of a better term, to actually make people comply.
Definitely. That is a big issue. And since they have requested more guidance, they have not heard any further guidance or more specific details on how enforcement will actually work at these parties.
And I think it is I think it's interesting to point out, though, like Chatham's police chief, Mark Paulinas, says that most people, or maybe it wasn't Chief Paulina, maybe I'm misremembering this, but I do remember in the article, they were saying that for the most part, people have been compliant. And so that, you know, there is this real concern and we have seen these parties. But on the other hand, too, people do seem to be respecting the fact that this is a serious situation and there are, you know, The governor's orders are in place for a reason, and so there is that element as well. And the ACLU has also weighed in with some concerns about some of the governor's orders. Am I right there?
Yes, the ACLU said that public health experts found that voluntary compliance was better than government enforcement. And they were also concerned that this would disproportionately impact Black and brown communities. Mm. They also wrote to us that they'll be reviewing this policy and its implementation carefully to ensure that it does not unduly undermine civil rights and civil liberties. And we talked to a couple of different people on the Cape. We talked to Reverend Will Mabane, or Will Mibben, in Falmouth, and he was echoing that concern as well, that there's too much evidence that, you know, police actions are not applied evenly across the board, that this means people with means and access to expensive lawyers can have, like, political influence and might get treated differently than those without.
Hmm. And that is Jessica Hill, a reporter with the Cape Cod Times, talking about a few stories from the paper this week. Jessica, thanks so much for talking about this with us today. Appreciate
it. Thank you. My pleasure.
I want to turn now to some news from Martha's Vineyard. The Edgartown Conservation Commission had some stern words for the managers of a historic farm after the town terminated the group's lease. And joining us to explain what happened is reporter Brian Dowd of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Katie.
So, Brian, what happened on the Katama farm?
So this is an issue that goes back to 2016, which is when the Edgartown Conservation Commission entered into an agreement with the trustees of reservation, which, as many people know, manage a lot of land across the state. This had to do with the Katama Farm, which is in Edgartown. And the trustees of reservation they took over the Farm Institute, which is this teaching learning farm at Katama Farm.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2016, they developed this use plan. It outlined kind of specific things that the town wanted to see done, and that was mainly agricultural production. And since then, the town has felt that the trustees haven't really met that use plan and mm-hmm. that they've strayed away from the agricultural production and gone more towards classes and teaching and special events. And so that's kind of like the crux of the issue here. And this week, the Edgartown Conservation Commission sent a letter to the trustees that said, you know, we're terminating our lease with you. We would like you off the property by September 15th.
Oh, wow. So they've got to pack up and go. There's not a lot of time there for them to wrap up.
Mm-hmm. And I spoke to the trustees islands director, Sam Hart, and he told me he was shocked and surprised at this. He said, he recognized some of the issues that have been going on, but he said he, along with the trustees, have been trying to work with the town to develop a new use plan. Part of this is because, you know, he said the 2016 use plan is old. The farm needs this and that, and they want to go this way with it. But ultimately, yeah, the town decided they just didn't want them there anymore and told them to pack up and leave.
Mm, so changes there. We'll have to see what comes down the line as to what the town will do with that space. It is a historic farm there in Edgartown. Brian, I want to do a quick update before I let you go on COVID on Martha's Vineyard. Health officials did report some additional cases of the illness this week. How are things going?
Yeah, so we don't have numbers today. Mm-hmm. We get those numbers later in the day. Yesterday, there was no new cases, but there were two new cases on Wednesday, one at the Martha's Vineyard Hospital and then another that the Martha's Vineyard Boards of Health reported. It was a person that was tested off island. Our latest numbers have that that new case at the hospital brings it to 43 positive cases. And that's since the hospital's been testing people in March. The other new case by the Boards of Health brings the total number of cases this month to 10 confirmed cases of COVID-19.
Mm. So we are keeping an eye as the summer continues along with the busy visitor summer season. And we will be keeping an eye as we kind of turn the corner as we are in late August and get ready for the fall. That is reporter Brian Dowd of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brian, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
You too, Katie. Thanks.
Welcome back to the Weekly News Roundup. I'm Catherine Ident. We're taking a look at some of the top stories from around the region and up at the State House as well. And even in an extraordinary year like 2020, August is still August on Beacon Hill, meaning hopes are dimming that major legislation on housing, unemployment, health care, transportation, and even climate change will be resolved before the fall. I talked about this and more with WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
So, Mike, it's happened, hasn't it? There was a crush to get some of these major bills done before the end of their typical session this summer. But because, as we've reported, the magnitude of what both the House and the Senate need to get accomplished, lawmakers agreed to an extension. But it seems like it's taken the air out of things, hasn't it?
You're exactly right there. August really is still a pretty typical August here. A lot of representatives and senators are kind of back in their districts, even though few of them have challengers. It's still kind of election and primary in the general election season. There was a lot of hope that the House and Senate could compromise on a lot of these bills, but for a number of reasons. One, just the normal procrastination of Beacon Hill. They really do wait till the end of their session to make these types of compromises, even in a good year, in a non-emergency year. That is the way of things. Because of the pandemic, that has pushed a lot of things aside. Because of the budget crunch, also because of the pandemic, they can't really make too many financial decisions. They're waiting for the federal government to see if they're going to bail out states and municipalities with more funding. That has a lot of kind of moving parts that could affect what goes on at the state level. And a lot of these things are just kind of locked into what I would describe as the typical House versus Senate stalemate that we've seen year after year, where the two chambers, which are controlled by Democrats, just can't see eye to eye and develop compromises on bills like unemployment, transportation, borrowing. There's a climate change bill. There's a housing and economic development bill, a healthcare bill. These are all still pending in these joint House-Senate negotiation committees. And they are trading proposals with some expectations that they will get hammered out, but no one really has any expectations that they're going to get anything done really before the fall. So it's kind of a more typical routine of let's just put our heads back together in the fall rather than push through in this emergency time frame. The only exception to that would be the police reform bill that supposedly was going to get pushed through rather quickly with some urgency, but we haven't seen any kind of compromise yet. That's in the same bucket of wait and see that the rest of those issues are. So it really is just kind of maybe check back in the fall when lawmakers really do get back to work.
And I can't help but wonder if when we do check back in the fall, because we will, if we will have a similar conversation, because as you mentioned, procrastination is one of the big factors here, and this is not new. We see this every session where they wait until the 11th hour. So it's going to be really interesting, especially in a very tense election year and a pandemic, to see what kind of motivation our lawmakers have up on Beacon Hill when the fall does roll around in a few weeks. And speaking of a few weeks, the state's primary election is a few weeks away. And while Secretary of State William Galvin says Massachusetts is ready for mail-in and in-person voting, he's a little bit concerned about Postal Service interference. That's been a big story this week.
Yeah, so it's been resolved a little bit after Galvin spoke with the Postmaster General backing off on some of those changes that were announced earlier. But there's still a lot of concerns that if Massachusetts, as well as the rest of the country, is really going to rely on mail-in voting in a way that they haven't before, will the post office be there to really provide that service in a timely enough way that the election can go off? And so, again, we have a primary election on September 1st. That's right around the corner, and then the general election in November. So Galvin said that over 1 million ballots have been requested just for the primary in Massachusetts alone. And so local clerks in the municipalities are getting those out. A large proportion of those have been returned back to those polling places. They won't be counted until Election Day, but they're being kind of queued up and organized so that on Election Day, poll workers can then start, you know, ripping open those envelopes and counting those ballots. And Galvin's office actually has a new website, trackmyballotma.com. Voters can confirm if their ballot has been received by their poll worker. So it'll kind of check them off the list that it did go through the mail properly. That site's just a response to concerns of what's going on at the Postal Service to give people some kind of confidence that the system will and is functioning for them.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the primary on September 1st, what does it look like from your vantage point? Is it going to be a busy night?
There's not a ton going on. Obviously, on the congressional level, there are, you know, there's United States Senate primary between Ed Markey and Joe Kennedy that is going to be potentially a tight one. Those campaigns are, you know, in the final stretch now. Western Massachusetts, Congressman Richie Neal has a challenge from Mayor Alex Morse that is, you know, getting a lot of news coverage lately for kind of dipping into a scandalish area. People can look up on that. And then Kennedy's old seat that he's giving up. The fourth congressional seat has, you know, close to a dozen candidates on the Democratic and Republican side that are vying to replace him, and that seat is really heating up over the last, you know, week or so. Those are the biggest, you know, congressionally. There are some Democratic primaries for the state house. There are very few Republicans. I think there's only four or five competitive Republican races this primary season. There's that sandwich race between Tom Keyes and Steve Ziaris from Barnstable. So that's one to look at. I believe that's Randy Hunt's seat, the departing representative. So an open seat is always a more interesting thing because these incumbents have so much insulation from challenges. You know, challengers just don't really ever lose. But when one retires and you get an open seat, you do get some interesting dynamics going on when they talk about what the state does, you know, as far as taxes and health care and all that. So we're seeing those come out more and more in these races. But all in all, it's a very slow primary election season. Very few sitting Democrats have been challenged. Very few incumbents have been challenged by their own party. And many, many, many of these lawmakers are going to cruise to re-election because there is just no opposition.
All right. And that is Mike Dean, WCAI Statehouse reporter. Quick note, early voting for the primary does start on Saturday. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
No problem.
Some local emergency responders, in other news, say the number of false 911 calls they've been receiving has surged over the last few years. And WCAI Sam Houghton wondered why, and he's here now to talk about what he learned. Good morning, Sam. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning, Kate. Thank you.
Sam, why the huge uptick in false 911 calls? I mean, we're talking big numbers from like a few in a month now to hundreds of false 911 calls in a month. What's up with that?
Yeah, I spoke with the Agatron Police Department. They brought this to our attention. We did confirm it's happening in departments around the area. But for example, the Agatron Police Department had 50 times the number of false 911 calls this past July compared to July of 2018. So I spoke to Chief Bruce McNamee. There he's the chief of the Agatron Department. Just to break it down, he said they had just 25 false calls in July of 2018, and then 127 the same month last year, and then 222 this most recent July. We also heard that Plymouth Police Department had over 50 of these false 911 calls over just one weekend. McNamee says that, it's a lot. So McNamee says the increase is entirely because of cell phones, and it seems like the newer models of phones are the culprit. It actually almost happened to me. If you press the right buttons on your phone all at once, you know, whether you're sitting on it or jamming it into your car cup holder, that can prompt the phone to call 911. And actually, Chief McNamee says they've had a lot of calls from people in boats or in cars. So it seems like when people try to secure their phones, that's what it can prompt the call.
Oh, wow. So it could be pressure from an inanimate object that can actually make a phone call on your behalf. Wow. Aside from just the sheer volume of calls, and that takes up a lot of time for dispatchers and first responders, I imagine this causes other issues, right? Is this a complicated problem for them?
Yeah. Yeah, I think when Chief McNamee says, you know, he hopes it doesn't get to this point, but he fears that it could lead to some officers not responding with the same urgency as they might otherwise. If you think the hang-up call is used for what can be pretty dire situations, it might be someone that is, you know, choking, or they can't talk over the phone, or it might be someone in a domestic dispute that can't talk over the phone. So something that seems kind of, you know, silly, calling 911 because your phone needs to be tied down, could lead to an actual problem.
Is there anything people should do if their phone does make an accidental 911 call, Sam?
Yeah, so the important thing here is, you know, don't hang up. If you do accidentally call, you know, talk to the dispatcher, tell them it was an accident. It's important to note here, if you don't, they will be able to reach you. They can track you down using GPS coordinates, and that's going to take a lot of time off of their, you know, when they should be doing something else. So, you know, if you make the call, just go through it and talk to the dispatcher, and everything will be all right after that.
Okay. So don't just hang up. Actually talk to that dispatcher if your phone makes a call on your behalf. The NAACP in New Bedford released a report this week, Sam, that found a lack of representation among staff and teachers in the New Bedford school district. The study found that 90% of teachers in that district are white. Talk about this report and why the NAACP released these numbers, what they were looking for.
Yeah, so their mission includes, you know, among other things, ensuring that education is equal for black and brown communities. The local chapter in New Bedford, they wanted to get a bird's eye view of what, you know, make up the staff at the New Bedford schools. What they thought was it would look similar to the makeup of the school population. You know, the students there is about 40% Latinx, over 10% black, and about 40% white. But what they found is that all staff, administrators, teachers, and, you know, and professionals were predominantly white, and this was the case for the last decade. The study did look back for 13 years. They also found that black and Latinx staff were typically holding lower level positions as well. So the NAACP, they put out a press release this week saying that the report, you know, reveals what they're calling disturbing data that confirms there's been little progress in hiring, promoting, and retaining employees of color in the district. I spoke with Lacella Hall, or Lacelle Hall. He's the president of the New Bedford chapter. He said that they just completed the report only recently, so there's still a lot of work to do and a stat to look through, but it's concerning to him and their membership.
Mm. Are they hoping, is the NAACP hoping that the school district will take this and try to make some changes? Are the two working together on this issue?
Yeah, they said that they are working together, and important, Hall says that, you know, what they're trying to do is get the schools to be better about recruiting. One of the things the school said in response to these numbers is, well, it's very hard to compete with other, you know, urban schools in Boston and Cambridge, but Hall is saying, well, we can work with you. Maybe we could look outside of Massachusetts and to get a more diverse teaching staff.
Mm. And that is WCAI reporter Sam Houghton talking about two hugely different stories there. Sam, thank you so much for your reporting and for coming on to talk about what you learned this week.
Thank you, Katie.
And I also want to thank WCAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff for talking about the stories they followed this week, along with Mike Dean, who reports each week from the State House in Boston. I also want to thank Jessica Hill of the Cape Cod Times and Brian Dowd of the Martha's Vineyard Times for their contributions as well. And I also want to thank you for listening to the weekly news roundup right here on WCAI. I'm Catherine Ident. Have a great weekend.